Next up, the incredible story of Shag Harbor. That's on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're back with Joe Montaldo, and he heads up an organization called the International Community for Alien Research. Joe, Shag Harbor, an incredible story that occurred in October of 1967. What kind of work have you been doing in that arena?
You know, we started digging on Shag Harbor back about 10 years ago, as much as, because I got to be honest with everyone who's listening to us tonight, Shag Harbor is probably one of the best UFO cases there is, simply for the fact, as I heard George note earlier in the show, there was multiple witnesses to this, and no one reported this as a UFO. Most people thought this was a plane that went down in the harbor. There were several people who went out to investigate it from the weird yellow foams and quite a few other things, but what I found interesting, in the last 3 or 4 years, we've had several people come forward now. Most of this is really hard to confirm, and a lot of this we're still working on confirming. Okay. There was a gentleman named Marsh who came forward and said he was one of the divers present when this thing was parked off the coast of Nova Scotia.
And let's review just real quickly, Joe, what happened. October 1967, a UFO about 60 feet in diameter was hovering over the water near this tiny fishing village called Shag Harbor in Nova Scotia. It had four bright lights. It was tilted at a 45-degree angle. It descended rapidly towards the water. We don't know if it went there on purpose or if it was crashing. Upon impact, there was a bright flash. There was an explosive roar. Could have been the propulsion system. Who knows? And let's pick it up from there, then.
And basically, this is what we have. I mean, you had several people go out in boats from different town officials to just everyday Joe walking down the street that happened to see this. Now, when they got out there, no one actually found a craft at the time. They did see something glowing under the water, and they did see the different, which the foam, I've heard the foam described by four or five different people now. They're describing the same foam. For some reason, they describe it with a slightly different smell. Some people say it has a sulfur smell. Some people says it has more of like an electrical smell, like when you're burning, like an electrical motor when it's burning up that particular wine smell it has from the windings. But anyway, at that point, this thing had actually left the harbor. It was seen leaving the harbor and headed out to the ocean. Now, to the best of everyone's knowledge, this thing parked off the coast of Nova Scotia for 7 days. This wasn't an isolated thing, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, where it hit the water, stayed there, and then no one ever said anything about it again. This thing actually took off underwater, made its way out to the ocean, up the coast, and parked off the coast of Nova Scotia, where there were several both Canadian and American naval vessels.
It was tracked, wasn't it?
It was tracked. It was tracked by the U.S. Navy and by the Canadian Navy, from what I understand. And the thing about this is significant. And there are several eyewitnesses, both from the Navy and from people standing on shore, that said they seen divers going in the water on a regular basis. Now, the original report I heard 10 years ago said there was two divers present. Now, here we are in 2007, and I'm hearing more along the lines of 20 or 30 divers, which sounds more reasonable to me if you're trying to recover a saucer or a ship that went down. You know, at this point, I don't want to say it was extraterrestrial, but as far as I know, we have nothing that can fly in the sky, go underwater, and I mean, it impacted the water. From the way the witness described this, it impacted the water hard.
That's right. And there were a lot of UFO reports prior to the UFO going into the water.
Well, there was also a brownage reported in, don't hold me this, I think it was Quebec, Canada, the same, about an hour prior to this thing going down, which was common with the UFOs back then with the power grid for some reason or another. So it just adds more credence to what was going on here. Now, to the best of our knowledge, we have nothing that could impact the water as hard as this thing did and then take off underwater and then stay emerged for 7 days underwater. I just don't think we possess this technology even in today's society, much less we're talking 40 years ago. So I don't think it was ours in any shape, form, or fashion. It's very important because you have witnesses at the impact site. You have witnesses that track this thing through the harbor, both people who work for the service that said they were tracking it with sonar, and eyewitnesses in both that said they could see the glowing object as it was moving along. So you have lots of witnesses from lots of different areas here. Unfortunately, now that the case is getting older, a lot more of these people are dying, but there's still quite a few of them around.
Well, and what we hear, too, is after the ships, now these are like Coast Guard-type ships.
Mm-hmm. Coast Guard.
sat over the submerged UFO for 1 week, watching it being repaired by yet another craft underwater. The flotilla is ordered to show challenge to a Soviet submarine that apparently decided to violate the 12-mile international limit in attempt to make contact with the underwater UFO. This is incredible, Joe.
It is.
And as this confrontation unfolds, both UFOs then leave the area underwater and move toward the Gulf of Maine, where they break the surface and fly away. This departure gives rise to a second major sighting on 11 October 1967 of two UFOs sighted in that area by multiple witnesses from Shag Harbor to Yarmouth. Isn't that incredible?
It is, and we tell people all the time, you know, people say, well, where's the evidence? I said, apparently you haven't reviewed Shag Harbor. I mean, just look at this case. I can understand if one little fisherman had seen this and one guy had seen it when it came out, okay, we didn't have a case, but there's entirely too many witnesses that are corroborating the same stories that have no relationship to each other in any shape, form, or fashion. And now in the last 2 years, we're starting to have divers come forward and talk about what they've seen. Marsh was telling us that he had seen, he had been sent down to see what was going on, and he was talking about the second craft when he seen what appeared to be a gray swimming without any equipment at all, approaching the other ship, which just blew my mind when I heard that.
Can you imagine seeing that? Did he freak?
Well, he said, well, I can't tell you what he said on the air.
No, you can't.
But basically, he said, basically, he was like, it took him, he said he almost killed himself because he was coming up as fast as he did.
You might be able to get away with saying it on your internet radio show, but you can't say it on this one.
Oh, no. I don't think I can get away with it there. But it was very graphic, to say the least, and it really scared him. And he said even today, 40 years later, it still scares him. He said, because as best as he could tell, even as advanced as the U.S. military is today, we could not have touched these things even if we wanted to.
See, and I think just what makes this so entirely credible is the fact that, you know, a flotilla of ships, there's a submarine involved, people are trying to figure out just what the heck's going on, and the fact that witnesses saw these two craft smash out of the ocean and take off, I mean, to me, that doesn't sound like a crashed airplane.
Well, as far as I know, I mean, George, you know anything that we have? We don't have any flying stuff that I know of.
Look, I was in the Navy 9 years, Joe. We don't have anything that could fly and go and get submerged, at least not that I know of, and not back in 1967.
Well, I'll tell y'all what. I got a little bit of experience with the Navy. I got 3 advanced degrees in electronics and 3 advanced degrees in avionics with the USS Navy. I was on the USS Nimitz.
Were you? Okay.
And the thing about it is, and you know, one of the first things you know, you're in the service. It's aircraft recognition. Pretty much everybody who's in the service learns this.
Yep.
And, you know, it's so, you know, when you hear a Navy person giving you a description of something he's seen, you pretty much can take it to the bank. That's what he saw. And when you have several of them from 2 or 3 different ships talking about, and it is something I found interesting because a lot of these guys are now in their late 60s, that they are willing to come. I guess they feel like they don't have anything to lose. But there have been several of them that have approached us and may be willing to talk about this on the air. And I would love to be able to corroborate one of these guys were on one of these ships at the time and get him on the air because it's a very significant story. And, you know, one of the other things I found interesting, too, was when they said, you know, how they were describing when the second ship was approaching the first ship, because there was divers in the water, by the way, from what I hear when the ship was coming up. One of the things I had heard as the ship approached the crippled vessel, the divers that were in the water near the crippled ship were actually moved away, what they described as some kind of field. It didn't hurt them or anything. It just pushed them. I think they said about 150-yard perimeter around both ships, and they couldn't approach any closer than that. It was like running into a wall. Now, I know that's a technology we don't possess. That's not even something we probably will possess for another 100 years.
A great researcher in all of this, Chris Stiles, says that most observations and statements came from professionals involved in the search, and that included military brass.
Yeah, and that's something I guess we didn't even mention that. There was an official search done in Shag Harbor for what they thought it was a small aircraft. Mid-size, something like maybe a Lear class or something along that class they thought went down in the harbor. And I think that's what most people don't realize is this was reported as an airplane crash. And there was an investigation done, and there was, well, not a full investigation, but there was an investigation done, and there was a search going on, an active search going on, until someone seen this thing leaving the harbor. And even then, most people didn't believe it when they seen this thing take off, which I would have been the same way. If I'd have been sitting in my boat looking and seeing this glowing light just take off under the water, I'd have been going, okay, maybe I'm in over my head here.
There was some report of some yellowish foam, which was coming up to the ocean top. Did you investigate that or find out anything more about that?
Most everybody seems to agree, and I really don't know if this is true or not, George, but most everybody seems to agree that they think there was some type of leak in maybe the fuel system. Because the foam, the few descriptions I've got, one guy said that, who was it? It was the young guy, I can't think of his name right now, but he was a young guy that was in one of the boats. The guy had picked him up on when he was walking out there. And he said when they touched the foam, that it kind of just disintegrated in their hands. It just kind of turned to air once it left the confines of the water. So it was some kind of chemical that evaporated quickly when it wasn't when it wasn't touching the water. So, and you know, if you've worked around JP4 or JP5, they're the same way. If they're sitting on top of the water, it'll float there all day. But if you take it and lift it up off the water, that JP4 will evaporate in a matter of seconds. And that's a high grade, you know, jet fuel. So I'm thinking maybe that's what it was. And that may have been why the other craft had to be there. I mean, if it had a fuel leak of some kind, it probably couldn't fly in space or in the atmosphere for long. But what bothers me is it was described as hovering, and then it went down. It was almost like there was an onboard explosion or something, and then it went down. Now, as far as I know, I don't think our government can shoot down UFOs, but I may have been wrong on that one.
Well, I'm going to read a little bit about this, too. During the story, the fantastic part about it was the quest, the attempted recovery operation at some point 25 miles up from Nova Scotia, mm-hmm. And that's incredible too. And again, that gets into where I'm talking about the Soviet sub and everything else. That just is amazing.
There's a gentleman, I think his name is Karanovich. He swears up and down, and I've heard him on a couple of European radio shows. He swears he was on board the Russian sub, and he says they had orders to intercept at whatever cost.
Why? But why would they do that?
Because they, I feel like, and this will segue to Roswell right quick, I feel like that we were given some technology, and probably the Russians and even the Chinese and probably now even more countries know that we were.
They wanted it.
And they wanted it. It was, they want to level the playing field, which you can't blame them for that. I mean, but if you pay, and I'm sure you're aware of this yourself, if you look at the United States over the last 40 years, technologically, we're leaving everybody behind. I mean, we're moving at a rate in the way we're designing computers and weapons, which really scares me, by the way, but we're moving in patterns that we're looking like we're 40, 50, 60, 70 years ahead of the Russians.
Yeah, we may be giving up manufacturing, but we are moving way ahead in terms of high technology.
And we are, and that had to come from somewhere. Granted, we may just be smarter, brighter, and faster than everybody else. I don't personally believe that's what it is. I just don't think that we're that much smarter than most of the countries on the planet.
Yeah, well, I think we're the best, but this is incredible technology.
Yeah, and some of the stuff I've been hearing about lately from the new missiles, from the new laser defense systems with the backup missile defense systems, you know, these are systems that we shouldn't be having for another 50, 100 years. I mean, some of the lasers I've heard about, you've seen the original Star Wars laser they were building, right? The one they used to shoot the disc up in the space out there.
Yeah, of course.
Well, that thing was originally designed, it was way too big to shoot down missiles. Wow. I don't know what they were planning on shooting with it, George, but it wasn't missiles.
You know, when we open up the phone lines next hour, if there's anybody who could call us from Canada on the international line, specifically out in the Shag Harbor area, please do so. I don't know why the case, basically, though, other than Chris Stiles investigating, was dropped. I mean, nobody followed through with it. What happened?
Well, I think for some people, they just got scared.
I mean, Stanton Friedman did some work on it in the beginning.
Yeah, I talked to him about that, but he really wasn't into it. I also talked to Whitley Strieber. He had done some forwards for some people, and it doesn't seem like most people wanted to get involved with this. And I don't understand it because the case was so good. If I'd have been around as an investigator when this happened, I'd have been all over this. There's just no way I could have left it alone. I'd have probably spent every dime I had just trying to figure out what's going on. But in today's society, I got to be honest, the witnesses are limited. And it's not so much the witnesses, it's being able to corroborate what they're saying. Because I can sit here and give you speculation all night long, but you know both of us want the same thing. We want to be able to say, hey, John Blow was out over here on top of this frigate at this time trying to recover this craft on this date, and that's what we're looking for. And getting that is really hard. And I have heard recently that there's been some records released. I'm waiting to hear about that. Some records released on Shag Harbor the military was holding on deployments, both for the U.S. and the Canadian Coast Guards. So that might yield something we haven't seen yet, George. But that's the thing. It's there's a lot of good witnesses, both in civilian and in military class. There was also some civil services witnesses as well. So you got a real good platitude of witnesses here. And you have a very accurate accounting of what happened from when it was above the water till it hit the water, and then as it went and found the other one. And then you have several good witnesses on what was happening while it was under the water. But you're right. Most investigators won't touch it. It's one of the cases we have posted on our website. It's considered to be one of the most credible UFO cases in existence. And we try to tell everybody about it because I want everybody at least to look at it. You know, even if you're a young investigator, you need to look at this case because it's going to give you an insight first on how advanced these ships are, and secondly, how our government deals with contact.
Well, and the fact that it moved up 25 miles.
Yeah, no.
That's the incredible part for me.
Well,
it moved away.
From what I heard, it just kind of just went. You know, it wasn't like this thing was in a real big hurry from the way I understand.
Right.
It just seemed to just move at its own pace. It wasn't like it was worried about the government or it wasn't worried about us.
How far down was it?
You know, when they set off the coast of Nova Scotia, they were talking deep, somewhere around a mile, most people say. Whether or not that's true, you know, that one's tough because sending divers down a mile back then, that's borderline.
You know, deep sea suits.
Yeah, that was borderline. And from the equipment they were telling me, they were wearing pressure equipment, but they weren't wearing that heavy gauge pressure.
Sounds like the movie The Abyss, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I'm thinking more probably around 500 or 600 feet is where I'm thinking they were sitting, but if we had divers in suits in the water, back then I'm figuring 500 or 600 feet. Now, if we had them in bells, that's different. But if we had them in suits, I'm figuring about 500 or 600 feet for back then. And even then, their time in the water would have been it would have been cold. They wouldn't have been able to stay in for long periods of time, 20-30 minutes tops, and they would have been back topside. Now, I was told, and whether or not we'll ever see this is anybody's guess, that there were both 8mm. And 35mm photos taken underwater and above the water of this thing by the U.S. military. So I would love to pay money to see that. But you and I both know it's not the military that's controlling these projects. Somebody else is controlling that.
Oh, that's true. I want to get your take on the Betty and Barney Hill case when we come back, Joe. Yeah. We'll also talk about Roswell. And then we'll open up the phone lines next hour as well, especially if any of you live in the Shag Harbor area in Nova Scotia. Check in with us on the international line next hour. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And Lex has linked up both of Joe's websites. They are right under his name at coasttocoastam.com. Joe, do you travel much? Yeah, you were mentioning you do go to a few conferences.
Yeah, well, I'll be speaking at Roswell this year for the 60th anniversary, so y'all all be sure to come down and hear me. It will be on abduction research, by the way. And there will be several abductees present during this and after. There will be a panel afterwards. But, yeah, I actually do quite a bit of traveling. On average, we probably log 30,000, 40,000 miles a year in. We're on the road a lot. We spend a lot of time, you know, between states doing investigation cases. We have an ongoing case that we keep in Gulf Breeze on. About 10 years ago, we noticed that we were used to go to this place out there on it's called Pearl Beach. It's in Gulf Breeze, Florida. And we started noticing people's cars parked there. And we started a research because they were never in their cars.
Where were they?
Apparently they were being abducted because they weren't there.
We'll be back. Don't go away. And we're going to open up the phone lines next hour with our guest Joe Montaldo. So that's all next. But when I come back, we'll talk about the Betty and Barney Hill case. It's incredible on Coast to Coast AM. It was this case that got me fascinated with UFOs. My mother brought me the Look magazine article that occurred a long time ago about Benny and Barney Hill. And Joe, after I read that about their so-called abduction, I was hooked. And I had to read every UFO book, every story I could find at a real young age.
Yeah, well, Betty and Barney Hill. Now, most people don't like my take on Betty and Barney Hill, George. I got to be honest with you. It's not that I don't think they had a contact experience. I don't know. Are you familiar with the Mill Lab experience? The Mill Labs?
No, tell me about that.
Well, the thing about it is when we go over their experience, we're looking for criteria. Okay, well, first, one of the first things that bothered me was the amniocentesis. I've interviewed thousands of contactees. They don't use a physical technology like that. It's not a needle. They're not using a needle-based technology. One of the first things that bothered me about the case. Second thing is she talked about walking up physical stairs. That's not something else you hear in 95% of contactees. And even the ones where they do say they walk in the ship, it's never upstairs. So those two things kind of stood out. And then she talked about, well, you ever listen to how she's talking? It's almost like a drug-induced state. Well, she describes it herself as a drug-induced state.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as far as we know, they don't use drugs of any kind. They don't really need them. They can manipulate the nerves in your mind quite fine or in your system without drugs at all. So as far as we know, they don't use drugs in any shape, form, or fashion. And we don't hear contactees talk about being groggy, or they'll talk about being, you know, feeling rough from having a contact experience, but either they remember or they don't. It's not a real groggy feeling or real, you know, like you'd been drugged up or doped up or something. And then the way she describes talking to the aliens, 99.95% of all contactees are telepathic communications. It's rare that you hear that an alien speaks. And most of the time, if they do, it's not something you can discern with your ears. In other words, you don't recognize the language. It's not English. With the reptilians and even with the greys, it's more like the dolphins' language than yours, like ours. So it's not even a word form language. These things stood out. So, you know, from what I heard and what I read about the investigation, everybody had assumed they were alien abductees. And I was like, well, there was definitely an abduction that went on here. But from my professional point of view, I would have to say it was a military abduction and not an alien abduction.
That's interesting. We'll talk more about that. Back in 1961, the Hills met a member of what was then the UFO group, NICAP. You remember that one?
Oh, yeah. I remember NICAP.
Now, this fellow's name was Walter Webb. He was a lecturer for Boston's Museum of Sciences at the Charles Hayden Planetarium. And he says, though highly skeptical of the case at the time, I was impressed that the Hills underplayed the dramatic aspects of the case. They were not trying to sensationalize. They did not seek publicity. And it was through Webb that the Hills realized that they had lost more than 2 hours during their trip.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he came away thinking, well, something happened to him. Like you just said, something did happen to him. And I had interviewed Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was the psychiatrist who did some work in hypnosis therapy with them. I can't find those tapes anymore. I was 21 years old when I interviewed him. That would have been 1971. And this case, of course, occurred back in 61, right?
Yeah, 61, yeah, 1961.
And so, you know, I wish I had them. But he began a six-month series of therapy at the Hills' own expense, starting in 1963, and they told, here's the thing, they both told, under hypnosis, virtually identical stories about humanoid-looking men dressed in tight-fitting black uniforms. Do you believe if this was a military operation, they tried to trick the Hills?
I think this was a deliberate attempt by the U.S. government to get this into the public, and I think they used Betty and Barney Hill to do it. I hate to say that because it makes a lot of people mad, but the thing about it is I think our government needed this subject to be in the American public for their disclosure project, because most people don't realize is the government is disclosing this. They've never denied the existence of extraterrestrials. They've never denied the existence of UFOs. You're not going to find any government official that says ET doesn't exist, because they're not going to say it. And they want this disclosed, but they want us to disclose it. And they're willing to let us go out here and do this, but, you know, they want it disclosed as much as we do. It's just they're not going to be the ones that disclose it, which I'm sure they have a lot at stake. But educating the population on this is a good thing. I mean, it's something that needs to be done, and I think if the government really wanted to stop it, they could stop it pretty quickly. So With people like myself, let's be honest, I travel a lot. If they wanted to make me go bye-bye, it wouldn't be real hard to stage an accident, or any of us, for that matter, who does this. So, you know, those with those things taken into consideration, it just seems like the government set this up so that they could get this work to the general public in a manner where it wouldn't be taken too seriously.
Well, John Fuller, who wrote the book The Interrupted Journey, which really jump-started this, and his book was pretty silent until Look magazine, as I mentioned, back in 66, took a couple two parts and excerpts from his book, made his book a bestseller. He unfortunately died in 1990 of cancer. I would have loved to have interviewed him.
And that's the thing. I mean, it's hard to get information. I was very pervy. I met a friend of Ann's, that's the friend, of Betty's recently, who had done a lot of interviews with her. And matter of fact, I did an interview with her, and we went over some of the information. And, you know, Betty's had contact since then, according to her, with extraterrestrials since then. But I remembered listening to the interviews. She's describing a different type of alien in her new contact versus what she's talking about in this particular case in 1961. And from what it sounds, it sounds like a physical technology, a technology that we would use. Everything that they described, even the type of craft, because they described it kind of like a banana or a pancake, more like one of the flying wedge type craft. It's the sounds of it. It sounds more earthly than it sounds extraterrestrial. And I really do think the government did this because, you know, she said herself they were human sized. They weren't, you know, the reptilians and the human aliens are both quite a bit bigger than us. So there's no, just, you know, when you see them, you know. And the grays aren't bigger than us, but they look so much different than us that it's not hard to tell. In her case, these aliens look closer to us. If they were an alien at all, they were a hybrid, because they do kind of sound like a human hybrid. But in this particular case, from the types of experiments done to the attitude of the contactee theirself, I'd have to put it as a military abduction.
What about the star map, though, that they came up with?
Well, you know, I found that interesting. And this was the dangest thing. I was talking about this one day on Pal Talk in a chat room, and we were talking about this, and I told this guy, you know, the only thing I find that really gives Betty and Barney Hill's case real solid credibility for being aliens is the star map.
Yes.
Well, about 2 or 3 days passes by, he brings me this picture of a rock from the Dogon tribe, and guess what map it was?
Well,
it was the same one Betty and Betty and Barney Hill. Helped and hurt them.
Well, I don't think they would have been aware of the Dogon tribe back in that era.
They wouldn't have been, but the government would have been. See, that's what I'm saying. Betty and Barney, I don't think there was any deception on Betty and Barney Hill's part at all, by the way.
All right. Now, that's important that you say that.
Yeah, I want everybody to understand that. I do not think there was any deception on Betty and Barney Hill's part at all. I think the deception was put on Betty and Barney Hill. I don't even think they, you know, even if they would have lived longer, I don't think they would have ever realized it. I really feel like because of the technologies involved in the abduction itself and the way the abduction was handled, you know, because we investigate military abductions today. It's not that uncommon. About one out of every 15 abductees experiences one. They're describing what Betty and Barney Hill is describing.
I'm gonna do something that I normally never do, Joe, and that's to take a side. Most of the time, I like to just go right down the middle and let the guests do their thing.
No, that's good.
But because the Barney and Betty Hill case really changed my life at an age of 16 years old and pushed me in the direction that I have now gone, and because of this case, I could not stop. I believe that something happened to them of some kind of magnitude that was out of this world. The military, my mind was too young to comprehend a military plot. And I'm not going to discount that at any point, but something tells me that something very alien and extraterrestrial happened to this couple.
Well, you know, I don't rule out the hybrid thing, because they may be using a more terrestrial-based technology, more human-based technology. So I'm not willing to rule out. It's just we can rule out, like, the grays, the reptilians, and the humans. We can just rule that out altogether. We know that was not the experience that Betty and Barney Hill had because of the research that we've done. So we can move them right out of there and say, okay, we know that's not what it is. So it doesn't leave it with much. It could be a new type of alien, like, you know, Charles Hall talks about the tall whites and stuff like that. So it could have been a different type of alien, or it could have been one of the hybrid programs, or it could have been a military. It could have been a combination, too.
Well, it's kind of funny because Barney, under hypnosis, when he saw the craft, thought it was military, and he said, how interesting. There is a military pilot, and he's looking at me. And then he realized, you know what, there's something strange here. He thought they were going to kill him and his wife because they had apparently seen some kind of top-secret military aircraft.
Well, that's
which is interesting.
Well, that's not that uncommon for a MIL lab to have a cover memory implanted over what they actually saw, because we'll find both. We'll find what actually happened, and then we'll find the government memory that was laid over it to make it into something else. That's not that uncommon of a thing, and it's a tough case because it does involve a physical-type technology. Even the reptilians and the humans, the human aliens, they use a physical technology, but much more advanced than what we're talking
about. Well, here's something else that's interesting. At the time, Peace Air Force Base in Portsmouth, right?
Mm-hmm.
They apparently recorded on radar, and it's in a report, at the exact same time the Hills apparently had their run-in with this UFO, some kind of strange, anomalous object on radar.
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
Actually, the way I heard the report, it was after Betty and Barney Hill, and it was a confirmation to what they had seen, but it was seen over the military base. It was actually sighted, physically seen over the military base. See, that lends more credence to the military abduction.
Well, whatever it was, the radar specialist registered it as unknown.
Oh, I'm sure he did, because he probably didn't know anything about it. And that's not somebody that's going to have that kind of classification. But the fact that it was seen in two different locations on the same night, and one of them being a military base, really helps put it more towards... But, see, that doesn't mean it wasn't alien either.
No, I know.
Well, I want to be honest, because I know people... I may be confusing people here that's listened to us, and I really don't want to. The thing about this is more than likely there was a government involvement in this case. What we need to find out is, was it a government-controlled case, or was this an extraterrestrial where the government was present and doing some of the monitoring and some of the experiments?
Well, now you may be onto something there. I mean, it's possible this might have been a joint operation.
Well, it sounds like it was, but it's going to be hard to prove, George.
Yeah.
But it does sound more because of the technologies used.
And the three players are dead. Dr. Simon is dead. Barney and Betty Hill are dead. And it's gone. Other than what we have is their tapes. And somewhere somebody has the tapes that Dr. Simon used when he recorded them.
I only ever heard the regression tapes one time about 26 years ago. And the thing about it is I haven't been able to find anything related to it since. And I have tried. I've called friends of mine that I know have really good influential positions, and nobody can seem to come up. I would just like to get a recording of the original cassette of the Betty and Barney Hill hypnosis and regression. And I'd like to sit down with some of our counselors, because we have our own people now that could, you know. Because one of the things I heard, and I got to be honest about this, one of the things I heard, and this is from some of the people who work with us that do regression, was that a lot of the questions asked during the regression would have been considered leading questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know actually how much of this now is actual memory and how much of it was actual suggestion.
That's why you got to hear it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and we have to hear it to determine that. And once we determine that, that'll also help a lot more in which direction we want to file this case in. You know, right now, if I had to file it and close the case, I'd have to file it as a joint case between some type of alien and the government. And that's where I'd have to file it. And I would like to know a little bit more detail before we get that.
Well, and even at that point, that's incredible.
Oh, yeah, it is. That's incredible. And you're not getting no argument out of me on this, because it is. And the case is a good case because it shows you that, yes, there was some kind of event that happened here that was earth-changing to these two people, just utterly earth-changing. And let's be honest, George, this is a black and white couple we're talking about who decided to go public in 1961 with being an abductee. This took an immense amount of courage. You know, neither one of these things would have been considered acceptable in 1961, and for them to come out and do this is enough to show the people right there something substantial happened to this guy and this girl that made them take the chance of putting themselves in national exposure.
There's something, Joe, out there by Zeta Reticuli.
Yeah, there's something out
there. That system.
Well, that and the Dogon system. Well, the dog.
And that's Sirius.
Sirius and the Sirius system, and because one of the interesting things about that is you know they found they have Sirius A, and then they found Sirius B, and then the Dogon also predicted Sirius C, which I think they found in 76. So they predicted the last two stars they found. Plus the Dogon, and this is what's always bothered me. You know, all these archaeologists and all these people want to have such a fit over the Dogon. But their calendar is based on the same exact orbit of Sirius B, 55.5 years. And they do know the composition of the star. That's an impossibility for an African tribe. That's impossible.
With no technology. And I don't think they had telescopes.
No, besides this, you have to have a radio telescope. It's invisible to the naked eye. You can't see it without a radio telescope. So we know they didn't have that. So these kind of things are significant. These are things that we can physically trace on our own planet, but yet at least 60% of the world wants to ignore it. You know, that always amazes me. What is it in us that doesn't want to know the truth? That's what bothers me. You know, Well, go ahead.
Go ahead. Finish up.
Well, I was just, you know, it just bothers me because in general, it's almost like 60 or 70% of the planet is walking through this brainwashed state of I'm the soccer dad, mom, I got to take my kids, I got to go to the store, I got to go to the mall, I got to have lunch, and, well, maybe there's aliens, who really cares? Well, it's a substantial thing, ladies and gentlemen. If the planet's being visited, it's the biggest thing that's ever going to happen to this planet. And I just, you know, for me, for the life of me, I just have to sit back and wonder why, because there's enough data now that if you sit down and do your homework, you can tell there's something going on.
Well, here, Travis Walton, 75.
Mm-hmm.
Shag Harbor, 67.
Mm-hmm.
Betty and Barney Hill, 61. Mm-hmm. Roswell, 47. Over a 28-year period, we've had some, and these are just several cases. We've had incredible cases, UFO cases, but we're not getting them anymore. Why not?
Yeah, well, we get them to an extent. I mean, you had the cases like Jaime Massange and reporting.
Yeah, and I'm not counting, you know, what we saw over Phoenix or over Chicago. We're not getting the close encounters of the third kind type cases.
No, we're not. Like what you just said about Phoenix, we got really good investigators out in Phoenix, you know, and they're investigating and they're telling us if they're flares, if they're not flares. But you're right, it's not the close encounter case. It's the case of the lights hovering over a city, hanging out, checking things out, moving around, but not ever really seeming to make contact. It's kind of a standoffish type sighting. It's a really good sighting, and as David Andrews, our Phoenix State Director, would tell you, it's very worth checking out and investigating. But it is not a close encounter of the third kind. Even the cases in the ones we're hearing in Florida now, which is a lot of sightings going on in Florida, there is no any of those. Now, I have to tell you, you know, I live in New Orleans, Georgia, and right after Katrina, I was home 3 days after the storm because I'm a contractor. And we started getting reports from both the National Guard and the NOPD of what appeared to be reptilian aliens walking on Elysian Fields in downtown New Orleans. Now, to the best of my knowledge, this is the first time anybody's ever reported anything like this. And we had seven reports of this. Now, just recently, I was informed by a friend of mine who's a friend of Linda Moulton Howe's that she's got a report of someone seeing a reptilian alien walking the streets in New Orleans. That in itself is just literally amazing to me.
Yeah, I think so. Stay with us, Joe. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And now we'll take phone calls this hour. We're going to keep the international line open to those of you who live in the Nova Scotia area that might have any information on the Shag Harbor incident from 1967.